How in the heck can a secretary of the Department of Energy, Samuel Bodman, even get up in the morning and think he has done anything but waste some of God's protoplasm if he can't run that department better than he is?
Catapult the propaganda. The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody. And welcome to February the 10th of 2008. Yet another day where we've seen all kinds of races and numbers and crunching of pundits on TV. I'm sick of it.
Well, the number that's important for us right now is about minus three, which is the wind chill here in central Indiana, as we look forward to several inches of global warming falling on us within the next 48 hours.
But you know what? I think I've got a cure for that.
Yes?
We've got a guest tonight that is going to heat up not just this conversation, but PID Radio downloads all across this week, all across the world.
It's a perfect week to talk to our guest. He is a staff reporter for WorldNet Daily now and the author of several books that are very important. One, of course, could be credited with torpedoing, pardon the pun, the presidential hopes of Senator John Kerry, the book Unfit for Command, Swift Boat Veterans Speak Out Against John Kerry. His most recent book, The Late Great USA. We're pleased and honored to welcome to PID Radio Dr. Jerome Corsi. Jerry, welcome.
Great. It's good to be with you tonight.
Fresh back from CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee meeting, and a lot. Of course, that was all over the news over the last 48 hours or so, and we may touch on that over the next hour, but really want to get into some of the things you've been writing about for WorldNet Daily over the last couple of weeks, because they relate to many of the topics we discuss here on PID Radio, namely the move toward global government. You've been writing, and of course, some of the other things that we talk about regarding the economy, specifically on global government. You wrote this week about the New Jersey, the Garden State Parkway in New Jersey being the latest in a series of public-private partnerships across North America. What is going on with that, and why is this something that Americans ought to pay attention to?
Well, it's very much the theme that I put into Late Great USA, my current book, and that is these public-private partnerships, which is a way, you know, the Trans-Texas Corridor, the four football fields wide highway, parallel to Interstate 35, you know, call it the NAFTA Superhighway. It's going to be built with money from Spain. Cintra, S-I-N-T-R-A, a Spanish investment consortium, is going to finance the highway and own the leasing rights for 50 years after the highway is built. And so to Texas, they'll be driving along. Everybody will drive along a highway, be paying Spain for the right to, you know, drive on this toll road. Now, the Bush administration has been promoting these PPP structures through the Department of Transportation's Federal Highway Administration. And Governor Corzine in New Jersey has caught on to it. We've got a $3 billion budget deficit in California, the largest after California, in New Jersey, largest after California and New York. And you're going to be seeing more of these budget deficits as the economy slows down. And the welfare payments and other, you know, legal alien payments, et cetera, are going to continue to go up. So there's going to be a lot of pressure on the states over the next few years. And what Corzine wants to do is essentially to create a what he calls a public benefit corporation, public-private partnership. He's got this new PBC term to it, public benefit corporation. Sounds like it's everybody, you know, it's everybody's good.
Mm-hmm.
And the public benefit corporation will raise bonds to lease the highway for 75 years and collect the tolls for 75 years to pay the lease, with the state of New Jersey getting a one-time payment of about $35 billion. Now, Corzine says this is better than leasing it to Spain because we're creating a public benefit corporation that leases it to the people of New Jersey. But the problem is that this PBC, or whatever you call it, in raising the bonds, could easily sell the bonds to foreigners, and you know the tolls collected over 75 years could go to the bondholders. So it could end up being the same thing. Also, I went to a hearing last week. It was out in Marlborough, New Jersey. There must have been 750 people packed into this, you know, Marlborough, New Jersey high school. And for 2 hours, a very angry citizenry challenged Corzine on the idea, you know, you're mortgaging your future for one-time payment, which you'll spend. You know, it's $35 billion. You'll pay off some state debt and make a few improvements. It's going to be quite a few highways, the Garden State Parkway, the Atlantic Highway, portions of the New Jersey Turnpike, and Route 440, which links the turnpike with the Staten Island Bridge. All of those will be leased for 75 years, the payments gone to the bondholders. And, you know, the bondholders are going to get a lot more revenue than the $35 billion they pay up front on a one-time basis for the PBC when those bonds are issued.
Well, that's the question. What's the projected income of these toll roads over the next 75 years?
The goal here, I think Corzine's goal is to make himself look good, raise money and say, look, you know, I've got this money now. I'm reducing the state debt. I'm still meeting expenditures. And the people of New Jersey were angry. I mean, they said, look, you know, you're mortgaging our future. What are you going to do the next time you have a budget deficit? Now, you're going to give up $150 billion in future toll revenues for, you know, seven decades to do this one-time bailout. And then others were pressuring Corzine, why don't you reduce expenses? An eminently reasonable idea. Get the benefits down, and if you can't pay the benefits, fine. Or reduce state pensions. Get people off state pensions. Part-time employees, they were pounding on some, you know, appointments that Corzine made that are going to be on the pension system. Corzine was, you know, very slick. He wore his sleeveless sweater. He took off his coat. He paced back and forth on the auditorium with his beard, and he answered in the microphone, trying to be reasoned and, you know, act like he knows better than all the citizenry of New Jersey what's good for us. And it did not go down well, because I think, you know, the people were saying, look, in 1952, when the New Jersey Highway Authority was created, its goal was to oversee the final construction of the Garden State Parkway. And the people in Jersey at that time were told it was going to be a self-liquidating toll road. Well, not only have the tolls not gone away in the New Jersey Garden State Parkway, Corzine's also saying we're going to need 50% tolls and increase in tolls in 2010, another 50% increase in 2014, another 50% increase in 2018, another 50% increase in 2022. I mean, these roads are going to become very expensive to ride. And
in that area, people are stuck. They have to drive those roads every day to get to work.
Well, that's right, Sharon. You know, the Garden State Parkway and the New Jersey Turnpike are two major north-south arteries in New Jersey, and they're going to be very expensive to ride. And it'll be detrimental to business in New Jersey, and it'll push traffic onto some of the rural routes and other routes that'll be not equipped, not ready to handle the traffic. And Corzine, Democratic governor, has come in. He's got the property taxes as high as anywhere in the country. Spend, spend, spend. And I think we're coming to an era very quickly here where all of these entitlement payments and other payments that the states and federal budget are taking on, including Social Security, are going to come crashing down. And if the solution, the Bush administration, the politicians, Democratic and Republican alike, Corzine's a Democratic governor, it's hard to tell the difference. Bush, you know, as a Republican president, has spent in a way that makes drunken sailors look good. You know, and this whole idea that we're just going to keep spending, 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 and we'll lease the infrastructure, I think the citizens were right. I mean, this just, you know, if you ran your budget like this, or you ran your home like this, or long-term if you try to run government like this, the entitlement payments just continue to skyrocket up. And the revenue is not going to skyrocket up. And these schemes, as good as they sound, are just schemes.
Let me just go on that, because I love the fact that you use the word scheme for two reasons. One is that we've got outside investors from other countries who are coming in. For instance, Cedra, which is partnering with McCary in, I think, the Chicago area.
Chicago Skyway, the Indiana
Zachary
Toll Road.
In another area.
Right.
They are using local companies as a front in order to buy infrastructure here in the United States. Now, Spain right now is our friend, supposedly. But we don't know what countries might buy those assets because these are literally assets on the market now. I just saw an article today at Credit Suisse, and they were talking about how attractive these infrastructure properties are becoming to investors. I don't like the idea that outsiders can come in and buy infrastructure, which is critical to our national security here in the United States. But the other one is that you use the word scheme because how do we know once they start building it, they'll actually finish it?
Well, or that, you know, they'll operate these highways the way the leases are written. I mean, already, like the Garden State Parkway illustrates, the tolls were supposed to go away on that road decades ago. But state governments don't give up revenue. They just increase taxes whatever they can, especially mm-hmm. when they get governors in place or presidents that don't know how to say no. And if you take a look at the title entitlement payments that we put on, not just Social Security, but the, you know, the structure of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, Medicare, et cetera, you take a look at the, I write constantly about the, you know, this gap accounting budget deficit analysis that the Treasury does once a year, where they show every year we've got a deficit not of, you know, $150 or $250 billion, which is on a cash basis, but our federal budget deficit now is in the neighborhood of $4 to $8 trillion a year. And we're building a negative net worth. This means when you account for the net present value today of the future Social Security and Medicare obligations that we're taking on that will eventually have to be paid out, we have then a negative net worth of $50 trillion. Now, in an economy that's, you know, $13 trillion, we're not going to be able to generate taxes in the future that will handle these kinds of growing obligations, which means that the idea that we're going to pay off Social Security or welfare or these entitlement programs, you know, Medicare, et cetera, in the future, it's not going to happen. Not unless we devalue the currency, which is what I've argued in the Like Rate USA we're having to do.
Well, that relates to my next question, and this touches on another article that you wrote about the Dow Jones and how the government's bailout package is probably not going to have any real effect. You wrote recently for WorldNet Daily that the economy of the United States is so weak that you expect or experts expect that the Dow is going to drop by, well, a third to about 8,000 in the near future. What can we expect to see coming financially in the United States as a result of these insane budgetary policies?
Well, it's been something I've been writing about, Derek, since I, you know, about 2 years ago, as I started doing the articles that led to the Lake Rate USA. It was absolutely clear to me that there's manipulation of the economy going on by the Federal Reserve, that this real estate crisis that we've been through, the bursting of the real estate bubble, all of this credit crisis, which is turning into an asset crisis, was engineered. And the article I wrote this week in WorldNet Daily, I think it was so critical because I was looking at the stealth methodology the Federal Reserve uses to depress the stock market, even when they lower interest rates, which makes it look like they're stimulating economic growth. I mean, what I was focusing on was an analysis that's done by Mike Bolser, who is a, you know, outstanding, he writes interventionalanalysis.com. And he's got an international reputation for these quantitative analyses where Bolser is able to make very accurate predictions of where the Dow is going, price of gold, etc. And he's watching these repurchase agreements. Now, the repurchase agreements hardly anybody knows about, but the Federal Reserve gives out a bucket of securities on loan, a repurchase agreement where they're going to take them back, usually about 28 days or less. Overnight, they even lend them out with overnight return. And there's a small list of 20 primary government securities dealers who are mostly top banks, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, etc. And these banks just get these securities that are repoed out, and they use them to buy futures contracts and other contracts to influence the stock market and other commodities markets the way the Fed wants them influenced. And so by measuring how much the repo agreements are that the Fed is lending out, Bolser has a pretty good a way to measure whether the Fed is trying to boost or depress the stock market. And the analysis he's done of the repo agreements against a 30-day moving average of the Dow Jones Industrial Average shows that the smaller amounts the Fed is currently lending out, about $18 billion a day in repurchase agreements, means that the pool is now going down to about $153 billion in unexpired temporary repurchase agreements, which sounds like, you know, a huge amount, but it's been double or triple that when the Fed has been boosting up the economy. And it's ways that these primary dealers go out and short the market and buy futures contracts where they anticipate the market's going to go down, and that influences the trading that's done all day long by hedge fund managers, pension fund managers, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So the argument, I think, is very credible, and I followed it through, you know, a few weeks' analysis. The stock market is now trading closer to 12,000 than it has for a long time. And remember, the high was over 14,000, and that was only on October 9th. You know, that's just October, November, December, January, less than 4 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, about 4 months ago, the stock market was at an all-time high. Now the Fed's taken it down almost 2,000 points. You look at it from that perspective, the idea could go from 12,000 to 8,000, another four is pretty dramatic. But I think Bolser's right. If the Fed continues to manipulate the market the way it's manipulating it, the Fed is pushing the stock market lower.
Now, for what purpose?
Well, the argument is that if we didn't do this, we would now have hyperinflation already. I mean, look at how the price of energy and the price of food have increased even while the economy is slowing down. We've got stagflation, stagnation of the economy. Well, we've got this tremendous inflation going on. And the way the Fed pumped up the economy with the mortgage, and this all this globalism, we're saying all the globalism, we're going to get cheap labor in China, and look at the corporate profits, all this effort to pump the market artificially, because it's totally artificial, you know, against free trade laws that we would allow companies to exploit slave labor to reduce the cost of their goods to be produced. They used to have anti-dumping provisions in free trade agreements that would prevent this. So the Fed is, you know, ultimately trying to manage the economy down while seeing the dollar diminish in value. But they don't want the inflation to push the value of the dollar down into a crisis mode. They want to ease it down. And I'm saying the long-term effect of this is we'll be told the depth of an inflation with a poor dollar, we've got no alternative but to go to a North American common market and a North American mm-hmm. union like Europe in order to compete. And we'll have to have a, you know, common set of regulations for our multinational corporations, which are pushing this agenda, and they don't want three currencies. They don't want the currency risk. We'll go to a regional currency on the way to a global currency to match the euro. And I think these economies, the economics are being manipulated to cause a stock market crash, to force the, you know, the severe recession, to ease the dollar down so it's not a immediate crisis, but still a lower dollar. So we get there in a few years, maybe 2-3 years more, this downward trend, that we could be offered the globalist solution of a North American common market, North American Union, which is what they've been wanting to offer since the European Union was created.
One thing that we've been watching over the last 6 weeks is a statistic that the Fed publishes, which tracks the amount of non-borrowed reserves by its depository institutions, reserves that the banks are supposed to hold just to do its normal daily business, if I understand fractional banking correctly, and I'm by no means an expert on finance. But over the last 6 weeks, Jerry, it appears that the non-borrowed reserves held by banks in the Federal Reserve System has dropped from something like $45 billion to a negative number, about negative $2 billion, meaning that if I understand that number correctly, entirely every dollar of the required reserves held by banks in the Federal Reserve System is borrowed cash. And I've been trying to do some reading on this, and I can't get a real read as to whether experts think this is a good thing, a bad thing, or nothing at all to concern about.
It's like those houses where they said you can get a loan for 125% value of the house.
Well, it's right, exactly. It's a coming crisis is what it is. I mean, look, the bursting of the mortgage bubble, it created an asset crisis because it's an asset for individuals. They can't sell their homes because the price of the real estate now is so depressed that you can't, many instances, get enough when you sell your house to repay your mortgage. Now, these mortgage loans were packaged together, collateralized mortgage obligations, and sold to the banks who held them in their assets. The bank did not hold the mortgage loans as assets. They held the collateralized mortgage obligations. They all sold their loans to these Wall Street packagers. But when the home loans tank, when they go into foreclosure, the collateralized mortgage obligations, despite their AAA rating, also go into the tank. And it's not just the mortgage loans, it's collateralized loan obligations in commercial real estate. It's a whole series of commercial loans and mortgage loans that have been packaged in this way, maybe $3 trillion worth, that are held by the banks and ultimately are going to be worthless. Now, when the banks have to mark to market the assets they're holding, which, you know, under Sarbanes-Oxley, they increasingly have to do. They can't just, you know, manipulate the accounting the way they used to. When they do that, they have to show that their assets aren't there, that these loans that they're holding, the collateralized mortgage obligations, are worthless, if not, you know, maybe 30% of their value. And what the Fed does is why the Fed has been opening the discount window and having these auctions on cash, money that you borrow from the Fed on the discount window and other, you know, short-term borrowing can be added to bank reserves and counted as bank reserves. It's borrowed money.
Now, do I understand? Now, I wrote about this at my blog, and I said, now, I have a limited understanding of this, but to me, this seems like if I were to count the equity in our home, which, of course, is a guess at a number, but if I were to count the equity in our home as cash reserves, is that a good metaphor?
It's a good metaphor. It's a good analogy to it, yes.
Okay.
It's basically what they're doing. That on a magnified basis, you know, aggregating all the different loans together and that form these collateralized mortgage obligations they're holding in their asset packages.
So what happens then if the value of these assets, the value of these mortgage, the value of the properties, rather, against which this paper is written, takes a dive?
Well, then the assets the banks are holding have to take a dive. And that's what's happening, is that the banks are holding worthless assets. So you probably got, right now, half of the banks, that if they didn't include their borrowed money, maybe more, would not have the assets they need to keep operating. They'd be technically bankrupt.
And there have been some experts who've written about that. Reuters posted a story this week, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes at PIDradio.com, quoted an analyst on Friday of this week as predicting that as many as 50 to 150 U.S. banks could go belly up within the next 2 years for this very reason.
Right.
And in fact, the comptroller of the currency for the United States, speaking to a group of bankers in Florida, made this statement, which I think is really eye-popping. Let's see if I can find it here. Over a third of the nation's community banks have commercial real estate concentrations exceeding 300% of their capital, and almost 30% of construction and development loans exceeding 100% of capital.
Ouch.
Right. Well, see, what's happening is that the banks are in an asset crisis now. So I say it's not a credit crisis, it's an asset crisis. They don't have the reserves to continue operating. And we've seen the very first wave of the banks going overseas, because in the mismanagement of this global economy is a disaster. I mean, you know, we've had China accumulate $1.4 trillion of foreign exchange reserves with our negative balance of trades to China. That's the most any country's ever had. 80% of it's in dollar assets. They mostly buy treasuries. But they're not going to do that much anymore because the treasury, the dollar is going down in value, and China doesn't want to be holding U.S. Treasury debt. Now, as this happens, and also the other source of wealth is we've been, you know, not developing our own oil resources, and I've been writing about this for, you know, a long time, years, saying we have oil in the Rocky Mountains, mm-hmm. the shale oil, mm-hmm. we've got mm-hmm. oil offshore, we've got oil in Alaska. As long as we remain dependent on foreign oil, now in the Middle East, and with oil now up to $90 a barrel, they've accumulated about $1.7 trillion in sovereign wealth funds, which is, you know, held by, say, Dubai or the various United Arab Emirate countries, the Abu Dhabi. And they're now coming back to buy assets, and one of the main assets they're going to buy is banks. It's either Dubai or Abu Dhabi that's bought 20% of NASDAQ now, mm-hmm. one of our two major mm-hmm. stock markets. There's something like 20% of Citibank that's been sold. Morgan Stanley, Bear Stearns, Wall Street, and banks are turning to foreign owners. So we're not only selling our highways and our, you know, government infrastructure, now we're going to sell our major banks and financial institutions. We're going to be owned because the foreigners, the, you know, the Dubai, you know, put back the foreign, you know, the sovereign wealth into buying bank stock, put more capital in these banks so they have more reserves, and the same will happen with China. In the process, I'd say going out 10 years, we may not own a major bank in the United States. They may all be foreign owned.
And this, I think our listeners, I hope, are starting to get the picture that all these topics we're touching on today are basically relating to a big picture, which is the wholesale sell-off of the United States, as though the country mm-hmm. and its assets are some sort of giant international garage sale that's being held for the benefit of foreign investors. Turning back to the sale of assets.
And manipulated by the Federal Reserve and caused intentionally. And remember, the Federal Reserve is not a... It is not a government institution. It's a private bank.
And that's the point I was coming to next. With the Fed and the U.S. Treasury and the large investment banks like Goldman Sachs, Lazard Frères, Lehman Brothers, and so forth, kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes, we look at the sale of assets and the long-term leasing of assets here in the United States and some of the high-profile ones that you've written about, like the New Jersey Parkway, the Indiana Toll Road, the Chicago Skyway, the Pocahontas Parkway, the Trans-Texas Corridor, and so forth. But there are others out there. There have been symposia designed to attract investors and pair them up, match them up with investment bankers to show them how to invest in American infrastructure. And you've written about this a couple of times in the past. Noticing that Governor Corzine of New Jersey was formerly the CEO of Goldman Sachs, how active a role – a two-part question. Number one, when Corzine proposed his public corporation, he called it, to – issue bonds. How does a corporation issue bonds, and what does a company like Goldman Sachs have to do in that process? And number two, how active are companies like Goldman Sachs in promoting this idea that America's infrastructure is up for sale?
Well, Goldman Sachs and the other investment banks will do the deal, so they'll make billions of dollars in fees.
So they, in other words, they make money just by issuing the bonds.
Yes, and the law firms do too. Remember, the Rudy Giuliani's law firm, Bracewell & Giuliani in Texas, is the sole legal representative of CINTRA, C-I-N-T-R-A, the investment consortium that did the Trans-Texas Corridor.
Oh, really?
You know, I didn't know that.
I did not know that. About that, too.
Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah, so the politicians get in on it with their law firms.
Holy cow.
And then, by the way, Bracewell & Giuliani becomes one of the largest campaign contributors to Governor Perry in Texas, as does CINTRA and as does Zachary, the construction firm in San Antonio that's going to build the Trans-Texas Corridor. So it's a big money game for the politicians and the investment bankers. And the consultants of all these deals, you know, under the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America that wrote about the late great USA, we've now formed the North American Competitiveness Council. We've let the Chambers of Commerce, the United States, Mexico, and Canada appoint 30 multinational corporations. And they're the only advisors that get behind closed doors with these working groups that we've created under SPP, our bureaucrats, Canada's, and Mexico's, which are integrating and harmonizing our business regulations into a North American format. And that's ongoing. So it's all a multinational corporate agenda. And the multinational corporations, yes, they'll suffer when the economy tanks, but they'll also position to take advantage of a more global situation, which this crisis will force.
So they're profiting from the sales that will take place of infrastructure to foreign investors, but then the crisis that results from this positions them as players in the becoming one world government.
And the United States would never have given up the middle class or our jobs or the dollar willingly. So, you know, the idea that free trade agreements are fair trade agreements, I pointed out, you know, the classical theory of free trade that was developed under economists like Ricardo, going back into the economists have been thinking about international trade since the 1800s. It was predicated on the idea of comparative advantage. A country might have a resource or a skill or ability, and it would just be cheaper for the other countries to buy it without duplicating the cost to develop it themselves. But it was never imagined that the comparative advantage would mean that the country uses slaves, subsidizes its currency, like China does, allows its corporations to destroy the environment, and exports defective products and goods, poisoned food, lead paint on toys. I mean, we're allowing that to happen. And with the jobs that we can't export overseas, you know, you can't send mowing our lawns to China. So what they do is they open up the borders, let an underclass come in from Mexico to exploit that level, let labor push the job down at the lower skill levels. Now, this destroys the American class. The multinational corporations of the North American Competitiveness Council, advising open borders for SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, George Bush, they know what they're doing. We had labor unions created, create a labor union in China or Mexico, it's against the law. We had labor unions created to demand that labor be part of the capital equation. You know, capitalists expect a return on their capital, and they expect the ability to go out and exploit labor, find the cheapest in the world. Well, the bloody fight we fought over labor unions in the 20s and 30s said no. Said labor is also part of the capital equation. Capitalists put in their money, labor, you know, puts in their work. And labor demands and can receive a fair return on their labor. That's what we got out of, you know, the 20s and 30s, the Wagner Act, the, you know, National Labor Relations Act, which allowed collective bargaining and formed unions. Now, if we just turn our back on that, and say, well, we're just going to go to China and use the slaves and let the slaves go to Mexico, which is what we're doing. We've opened to the economists in the know, the central bankers, the keys they need to force the depression and force us into more globalism. Because they know that when the jobs are gone, when the economy is destroyed, when the dollar is weak, we'll gravitate to their solution, which are common markets plugged into world trade, simply because we'll feel we have no alternatives to survive.
Now, people hearing this might, and I suspect, Jerry, that our listeners are familiar with and sympathetic to your views, because we've been talking about this on this podcast a long time, and many of them are people who used to listen to our discussions at the Eagle 93.9 in Columbia. But some listeners may be new to this concept of this North American Union, this globalist agenda, and think this is just internet conspiracy theory. In fact, Michael Medved had a very open and public dispute with you and called you a crank and a jughead and some other very nasty names. But
and I thank him for it. He made hundreds of thousands of people who never heard of the idea more aware of it.
Absolutely. Drove traffic to your articles at Human Events Online.
Made the book a bestseller. It's now in its fifth printing.
That's wonderful news. Wonderful news. They can't hide it behind the counter when they're selling that many copies at Barnes & Noble, can they?
Well, and also, the footnotes, I guess Michael Medved, he's a movie critic, isn't he?
Yeah.
I guess they don't have footnotes in movies. I've never seen a movie with footnotes. Subtitles, never footnotes.
But,
so I guess he's not used to going to the back of the book and looking up the documentation. Because if Michael Medved had an answer that could be argued by logic, reason, and fact, I suspect he would have done that. Mm-hmm. When he starts calling a name, you know he's already lost the argument. He has no other basis on which to just try to discredit mm-hmm. people from looking at it.
Right.
The 30 pages of footnotes, and there's dozens of government websites, start with spp.gov. You know, that's the Security and Prosperity Partnership's website, and just read the reports to the leaders on that.
Speaking of which, did you notice how many times during his State of the Union address this year, George W. Bush used the phrase security and prosperity?
Yes, mm-hmm. I did. I thought that was very interesting.
We took very close note of that, and we give you credit for opening our eyes to it.
Also, you know, the other part of that that was very interesting is that President Bush said there was going to be a summit meeting in April.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he called it the North American Leaders Summit Meeting. Now, mm-hmm. I was up in August in Montebello, and it was the third Security and Prosperity Partnership annual meeting of the leaders. Now, this meeting in April in New Orleans is going to be the fourth annual SPP meeting. It's going to be held under the auspices of the Security and Prosperity Partnership. But yet George Bush did not use those words. He avoided saying that. He gave it a new name. He changed the name. Now, I think that's because we've already, with our criticism and the amount of attention we've drawn to the SPP, we've made Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America radioactive. And the administration wants to deny they're doing it. And they've given it a new name under the idea that people will be fooled.
Yeah. Now, the meeting in Montebello was an interesting one, but there was another meeting that took place in the fall of 2006 in Banff, Alberta,
yes.
Canada.
Yes, yes.
About which you wrote. Tell us what happened in Banff.
Well, in Banff, and again, it was another meeting where there was a private closed-door meeting. This was one of the North American forums, another group George Shultz has put together, a former Secretary of State under Reagan. And it was a private invitation meeting. And a bunch of the elite, again, the government officials, U.S. government officials paid by the U.S. government to go to it, a secret agenda. And we got a hold of it. It was published in Canada. And we got the agenda, and we got the attendees, and we published it in World Net Daily. And again, Robert Pastor, the American University professor who's been arguing for a North American community in his writings for a decade, attended and gave a paper. And then Judicial Watch filed a Freedom of Information Act, and they got more papers from inside the meeting. And it was clear that all the – what we're talking about now, this North American integration agenda, was openly discussed for 3 days among these elite behind closed doors, no press allowed, where they planned and presented how they were going to force ahead this agenda to integrate North America. They were going to call it a North American community. You know, Pastor says, oh, no, I don't want a North American Union. Well, he's just changing the name. You know, I said in Europe, the European community was a prior stage, a prior step to getting the European common market and the European Union. So Pastor knows exactly what he's doing. In this meeting, secret meeting, again, now that we got the Freedom of Information Act request and we got a hold of the agenda and the attendees and published it, we expose that the meeting is going on. You know, it's more Michael Medved saying, don't worry about the man behind the curtain. Well, we pulled away the curtain, and you can see the man standing naked there doing exactly what we said he was doing.
And some of those guys behind the curtain included Donald Rumsfeld, who was Secretary of Defense at mm-hmm. the time.
Right.
Secretary of State, former Secretary of State George Shultz, as you mentioned, former CIA Director Jim Woolsey. Robert Pastor, of course, whom you mentioned, another former Secretary of Defense, William Perry, former Secretary and Energy Secretary James Schlesinger, and their corresponding officials from Mexico and Canada. So these
and top people out of the State Department as well.
These are heavy hitters.
They're heavy hitters. This is a serious North American meeting of top elite behind closed doors planning North American integration. And, you know, the model, look, it happened in Europe. Europe went through 50 years. They went from, you know, they said, oh, this is just economic agreements, you know, coal mm-hmm. and steel agreement in 1957. Well, we've now got the memoirs of people like Jean Monnet, some of the intellectual leaders who planned the European Union. And it's clear from, you know, Monnet's memoirs, his last sentence, he's, you know, saying that even a European community will not be enough. He needs a global community. And he admits openly in the book, said that, you know, we knew we couldn't tell outright the countries of Europe they were going to lose their sovereignty. But we also knew that if we lied, we put in these economic agreements, that the economic agreements would necessitate there being new laws among the countries, because the trade disputes would be international in nature among the European countries, and it would necessitate judicial procedures in order to resolve the trade disputes. So what they did in Europe is they created fait accompli. They allowed the populations to go and move and live wherever they wanted. Eventually they had a European Union passport. It's like here, we've got 10% of Mexico's population living in the United States today with 47 Mexican consular offices here to protect their civil rights to do so. Now, 2010, we'll have 20%, one out of every five people born in Mexico, be living in the United States as a Mexican national citizen, you know, with a full right to do so unless we stop it. And nobody voted on this. In fact, people have been clamoring to secure the borders, and the Bush administration, and if we elect Hillary Clinton or Obama or most likely McCain, you know, McCain has no history. He was with Ted Kennedy on the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill, arguing that we legitimate the right of these 12 million or 20 million or however many illegal aliens are in the United States just to stay. That fait accompli, once accomplished, forces the integration on legal bases. The elite engineering this know that's what they're doing.
Well, exactly, and I think that many of our listeners are thinking to themselves, well, our Congress will stop this. If we can just elect the right guy or get the right guy in the presidential office, the fact is that it's trade organizations, it's NGOs. These aren't being done necessarily by government, you know, instruments. They're being done under the table, so to speak. In fact, one of the organizations that the agreements, rather, that unites the world into one world is this lost treaty, the Law of the Sea Treaty.
Right. And, you know, I've been writing about that, too. And here's the issue with Congress and the presidency. I wrote an article last week that showed that all four of the top candidates are getting money from the same Wall Street firms at the same banks. Goldman Sachs, John Corzine, you know, and by the way, Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson's also Goldman Sachs.
As was his predecessor,
Right, exactly. So Corzine was a senator. Corzine, you know, was Goldman Sachs, now governor, former senator. So Goldman Sachs is a top contributor to Hillary Clinton, to Obama, to Romney, and the number five contributor to McCain. Now, in that case, Goldman Sachs wins. They'll have a friend in the White House no matter who wins, Democrat or Republican alike. You can't tell them apart. The only hope is at a grassroots level. And I've been writing about these, you know, state senators like Randy Brogdon, one of the state legislators in Oklahoma, or Steven Sandstrom, who's in Utah, who are introducing legislation, resolutions. I think there's 18 or 19 states that either have or are considering state resolutions that say no North American Union, no NAFTA superhighways. And I think we have to start at the grassroots level. Just like we blocked the Kennedy-McCain comprehensive immigration reform with a grassroots effort. But it's going to be very tough again because, you know, here if it's going to be Obama or Hillary, you don't hear either one of them talking about closing borders or stopping globalism or really renegotiating our so-called free trade agreements. And McCain has been on the other side of the equation. He's been fighting with George Bush to open the border. He's been doing that now for, you know, 8 years of the Bush administration.
Well, let me ask you about that, Jerry, because this is something that it really strikes me as being almost as fake as professional wrestling. Last summer, John McCain's presidential campaign looked like it was completely dead in the water after the American public rose up and said, we don't want amnesty. And McCain was shown to be one of the primary sponsors of this bill that would have extended amnesty. How is it that he could go from being dead in the water because of the rage of the American public at his support of amnesty for illegals to being the presumptive nominee for the Republican presidential candidate?
Well, you've got the stacked up primary process, which gives momentum to anybody who comes out of Iowa or, you know, in McCain's case, it was New Hampshire and South Carolina. And of course, the mainstream media globbed onto him immediately. And the mainstream media is also controlled increasingly by the multinational corporations. There's a big wink-wink game. You know, they know that McCain truly is an open borders guy. And they're traitor. You know, McCain has on his staff this Juan Hernandez as his Hispanic outreach director. Now, Hernandez, I wrote about this in World Net Daily. He is born in the United States, but he has a dual citizenship with Mexico. Vicente Fox put Juan Hernandez on his staff to represent the 24, 25 million of Mexicans living abroad and he was on the cabinet in Mexico. He's now on John McCain's staff. And Juan Hernandez, you remember, he's the guy with the that red beard. He looks like the Burger King guy. And he was arguing on talk, you know, television, syndicated news for years, saying Mexico first. He's famous for saying if, you know, Mexicans living in the United States down to the eighth generation, let them say Mexico first. And McCain has him advising him.
Huh. That's really sad. And, of course, we've also got President Calderon of Mexico now saying, you know, McCain, Obama, Clinton, I like them all.
Well, sure. And we're going to have Calderon here next week. He's going to be out in California with Schwarzenegger. And, you know, increasingly California is looking like little Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And Calderon knows it. He doesn't want the border closed. And he knows that none of these top candidates are going to close the border. Calderon knows Mexico wins with any of these candidates being elected. And, you know, the American people just got to say, no, I think it's the Republican Party on this issue could end up destroying itself. I think George Bush has gone a long way to do it. I was in CPAC last week when McCain spoke. They all spoke, including George W. Bush. When McCain spoke, he was booed. And if it had not been for the McCain supporters that they allowed into the meeting with the McCain signs, not CPAC attendees, who, you know, were there to cheer, McCain might have been booed all the way through a speech.
Hmm.
He mentioned in immigration he had to stop. He was being booed, catcalled so loud.
Well, I noticed what he said in response to their boos was, I promised to secure the borders. He didn't say close the borders. He said secure the borders. Well, I suppose you could argue in a way they're secure now. If you leave the border, if you cross the border as an American, you have to show a passport on your way in, out and on your way in.
Yes, but if you come across the desert, you know, which is what they're leaving wide open.
Oh, exactly. No. I'm saying it's not so much they're securing it to keep others from coming in. It's that we can't leave.
Well, that's right. If you read the Security and Prosperity Partnership SPP documents, they clearly state that the border perimeter they want to secure is the border around North America. They're going to have trusted trader and trusted traveler biometrics cards,
mm-hmm.
where Mexicans can, you know, come across with IDs, and just like the prelude to a North American passport. They've already got it. You know, Mary Peters is insisting on this Mexican – she's the Secretary of Transportation – insisting on the Mexican truck demonstration project going forward, which it is. And they're being issued RFID and identification chips and cards as trusted traders for the Mexican rigs, 100 trucking companies to go anywhere they want in the United States. Congress voted out that money in the Department of Transportation – fiscal year 2008 budget. Congress put amendments in. Senator Dorgan of North Dakota, Democrat, led the charge in the Senate. The amendments took away the money from the Department of Transportation to run this Mexican trucking experiment. It got signed as part of the Omnibus Crime Bill, or Omnibus Funding Bill, and is now law in the United States. Mary Peters, the Department of Transportation, says, we don't care. The trucks are going to continue to roll. We're going to ignore that law we started in September and it doesn't apply to us. The amendment wasn't discussed until, you know, October. Well, the legislative council to the Senate wrote Mary Peters' letter and said, no, legislative history of that amendment was to stop the exact pilot test. You started in September and you're refusing now to stop. So Mary Peters is in violation of the law. And Congress is starting to let her know this. Now, what Congress is going to do about it, I don't know. The Teamsters have started a Fire Mary Peters campaign with bumper stickers and posters and the Metro site in Washington, the subway site right by the Department of Transportation. And I suspect that will gain some momentum. But the Bush administration is violating the law that they signed into effect.
Well, that's nothing new with the president's use of the signing statement. It's par for the course for this administration. In the last segment here, Jerry, I just want to change gears for just a moment because this relates to a couple of other books that you've written, Showdown with Nuclear Iran and Atomic Iran. This past week, Lou Dobbs on CNN had a meltdown of apocalyptic proportions in reporting that the Secretary of Energy, Samuel Bodman, was really unable to explain to a House subcommittee why the United States government is funding a Russian research institute that is helping Iran develop its nuclear program.
Well, in fact, Russia now has delivered all the energy, the nuclear energy, to Iran, needed to start up this Bashar nuclear power plant that Russia built for Iran. And Russia is also negotiating now with Iran to deliver an S-300 surface-to-air missile system, a defense system, which will not only take out cruise missiles, it take out ballistic missiles and jet fighters. It's probably the best in the world. This system, when Iran gets it, might, you know, from Russia, might make it almost impossible to attack their nuclear establishment.
Now, under what possible series of conclusions would it make sense to finance through Russia Iran's nuclear program and then turn around and tell us that Iran is a threat that must be contained at all costs?
Well, it's ridiculous. We still give Russia foreign aid. Why do we do that? Russia's got all the oil they need. They're one of the leading producers of oil now in the world.
They've got the best economy. They paid off most of their debts.
We're giving them foreign aid.
What? Why?
No, and we work with the Germans and the, you know, the French and the Security Council to put sanctions on Iran. The German and the French companies are in there helping Iran with their nuclear program. They assisted Iran in launching this rocket. Iran successfully launched last week, put into orbit a rocket. They said this is for research purposes. Well, you know, our government's pretty well convinced that that is the basis for a weapons program. The same technology you would need to put a rocket into orbit is what you'd need to develop a ballistic missile capable of holding an atomic payload. And, you know, the Russians and Germans are helping the Iranians do that.
So
how can they put sanctions through the UN against Iran if they're also having business ties with Iran and deals like we just discussed?
I don't know. And that's why I wonder, does this relate to the coming one world government in any sense? I mean, again,
it does, except that, see, you know, Iran's not playing by the rules. Iran has learned that they don't have to listen at all to the West. They haven't complied with the UN requirements or sanctions. They're not working with the International Atomic Energy Agency to control their nuclear program. Iran's on its own agenda. They're Shiite radicals, and they're sworn to destroy Israel. They're taking and building nuclear weapons under the guise of these peaceful programs, and they're continuing to fund out of Iran with their oil money Hezbollah and Lebanon, which now launches some 26 or 27 rockets into Israel every day. Israel just had a war a few months ago to try to get those rockets out of Lebanon. They're completely resupplied in the Hezbollah in southern Lebanon from Iran. Iran is also funding Hamas in the Gaza Strip. Hamas has taken over the Palestinian Authority and again has sworn to the destruction of Israel.
And yet the United States is continuing to send money that being funneled through Russia to aid Iran, and it just makes absolutely no sense at all.
No, it doesn't.
Regardless
like,
of your views of, you know, where this is going, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
No, and it looks like Israel is going to be forced to go in and take out those nuclear facilities.
In both books I wrote that we would go through this process under the Bush administration, failed negotiations. We would fail to have effective sanctions. We would fail to stop Iran. And the final analysis, Israel, which has been begging the world to assist in stopping Iran, and it could be done. And we stopped South Africa from apartheid without a war. But the union, you know, there was union then. The idea of, you know, racism was a popular leftist theme, and it was easier to get coalition among the states of the world to stop apartheid in South Africa. You don't have the same political correctness against Iran and, you know, radical Islam to stop Iran. So the final analysis of both books, I concluded that it would be the Samson option. Regardless of this being a disastrous war and the worst possible solution to the Iranian problem, Israel, the final analysis, will go to war and will probably join them. And that war will be an enormously difficult, possible regional war, maybe a nuclear war of global proportions. We're headed there. I wrote about it in 2005 in Atomic Iran. That's how I concluded the book.
Well,
it's happening. Everything I wrote about in that book is happening.
And again, you can't talk about events in the Middle East without looking at the without looking at that as a potential conflict. And the word Armageddon comes to mind if you get into a global nuclear conflict. It's not a pretty thought. Jerry, we just have a minute or so left here with you. You were the darling of the conservative media back in 2004 when Unfit for Command was out, and you basically pilloried John Kerry. What kind of response do you get from the conservative media today when you're writing about the SPP in the late, great USA?
Well, I think my reputation's increased dramatically along the conservative movement. When I go to CPAC or other meetings of conservatives, and I'm very well received and very well known.
True conservatives.
Yeah. Yes. Now you go to the Republican establishment, they don't like me criticizing Republicans, or you go to broadcasters like Medved, who are really reducible to becoming Republican shills. Well, I'm not very popular with those guys because they've been trying to teach people for, many years, vote Republican and don't worry about it. Everything will be okay. Well, when the Republican Party is not a conservative party, when it's embracing comprehensive immigration reform and unfair trade and globalism, well, it has nothing to do with conservative principles. I want to preserve, protect, and defend the United States of America, whether or not the president remembers it was, part of his oath of office to defend the Constitution.
Well, Jerry Corsi, Dr. Jerome Corsi, the author of The Late Great USA, his most recent book, also, of course, Unfit for Command, Swiftboat Veterans Speak Out Against John Kerry, Atomic Iran, and Black Gold Stranglehold, the Myth of Scarcity and the Politics of Oil. We'll need to get into that sometime.
We're going to link to those books if you want to buy
them. We'll put links to all of those in the show notes at PIDradio.com. And, of course, you'll find his writing on a regular basis at worldnetdaily.com. And
Jerry, did I see a press release that you've just joined a group called The Vanguard?
Well, that's in the works. The Vanguard wants to oppose the Democratic candidates, especially Hillary Clinton, but also Barack Obama.
Sort of an anti-moveon.org?
Yes, kind of a counterpart. And there may be some funding. If I could do some research, I might write a book on Hillary or on Barack Obama before the election. But it would take some funding to be able to do that. So that's what, Vanguard.org is trying to do, get some funding together to do that opposition research.
Okay, so if our listeners want to go to thevanguard.org, there's a place that they can sign up?
Put thevanguard.org, and you can see sign-ups and you can join.
Okay, well, we'll link to that in the show notes as well.
We certainly will. Jerry, we sure appreciate your time. Every time we talk to you, it's really interesting and always learn something new, like the connection between Rudy Giuliani and the Trans-Texas Corridor. Something I didn't
know.
That's a good one. Pleasure to talk with you, and we look forward to talking with you again.
I look forward to it. I'll be happy to come back anytime you ask.
Terrific.
Wonderful. If you've got any questions, you can always write to us at Derek@peeringintodarkness.com or Sharon@peeringintodarkness.com. And, of course, the show notes for today's topics will be linked at PIDradio.com.
Well, I think that wraps it up. You can also go, by the way, to discuss things. We'll put a link at the end of every show note post that you can go to piercingthedarkness.com and discuss things over there. And we'll also, as Derek said, link to all of the books you can buy by our wonderful guest, Jerry. And we're so glad you were here with us. In the meantime,
I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
news and analysis on demand.
This is PID Radio.